A map showed only a single well, called Dibi, which Thomas had located at the end of his great journey across the sands. It was about 150 miles away, in a depression to the south of the Qatar Peninsula. 60 miles to the east of it were the salt flats of the Sabhat Muti, which, starting on the coast, run southward into the desert. Al-Auf had once told me that camels were sometimes inextricably bogged in the Sabhat Muti after rain, but that they would never be engulfed, as in the al-Samim. I told the others that I could take them as far as Sabhat Muti, but that I neither knew whether I could find Dibi well, nor whether its water would be drinkable. I vaguely remembered Hamad telling me the year before, when we were in Dafara, that all the water near the Sabhat Muti was brackish. However, Mohammed said that if I could guide as far as the Sabhat Muti, he could then guide us to Abu Dhabi. I was doubtful about this, but we had to go on, since we should starve if we stayed where we were. The others reassured me by saying that we were certain to encounter some of the Murrah before we got to the Sabhat Muti. We decided to fill the 10 water skins which we had with us. This would mean that our baggage camels would again be heavily loaded, but we were quite prepared to sacrifice them in order to save our riding camels and ourselves. 3 of them, and Muhammad's mount, had developed deep, evil-smelling ulcers on their humps and withers, where the saddle swellings had burst, and the skin sloughed away. Amir cut off lumps of mortifying fat and flesh, which he said it was better to remove. They paid little heed to this operation, so I hoped it did not hurt them too much. My companions were always prepared to endure discomfort and even hardship to save their camels. But, inevitably, the hardness of their lives made them callous to all pain. Desert people can be as callous about their own sufferings as they are about the sufferings of others and of animals. I remember I once hired a camel in Tibesti. Its owner was to come with me on foot, but as we started, I noticed that he was limping. I asked him what was the matter, and he showed me his bare feet. He had worn through the soles on a recent journey to Kufra, and was now walking on the raw flesh. The mere thought of his pain made me feel sick, and yet, because he needed the money, he proposed to walk across the mountains. But if Arabs are callous, they are never deliberately cruel. It would have been inconceivable to my companions that anyone could derive pleasure from inflicting pain. Although, to avenge a death, any of them would have knifed an unarmed herdsboy, not one of them would ever have tortured him. Many of the RAF stationed at Aden believed that they would be castrated by Arabs if they came down in the desert, but I am convinced that no Arab tribesman would do this. The very idea would revolt him. Once, when I was telling my companions about the Danakir, I mentioned that they castrated the men they had killed. They were really shocked, and Amer said disgustedly, "They must be animals. No human being would do a thing like that." The next day we crossed some salt flats to the far side of the Jabrin Depression, where we found a few bushes which had been touched to life by a shower of rain, and there we stopped to let our camels feed. I was again surprised how local were many of these showers, wetting only a few score acres. In the afternoon we rode across a gravel plain marked with many tracks. Towards evening a grey haze from the north came down, blotting out the emptiness that lay beyond. After dinner, Muhammad insisted that we must have more to eat. I suggested facetiously that he should go off and buy some flour, and also a goat while he was about it, but he grumbled that they could none of them go on unless they had more food. I maintained that our supplies would barely last us, and that it would be idiotic to increase our rations, and asked him what we should do when our flour was finished. He said, "God will provide." But I, not having Elijah's faith, doubted this. We argued angrily, and finally I got up, telling them that they had better finish the flour that evening and then we should know exactly where we were, and went off to bed in a temper, thinking indignantly, "I am just as hungry as they are, but less improvident." Next day we ate the same ration as before, and nothing more was said about it. We travelled for 8.5 hours until we reached the western edge of the Jaub Depression, which I hoped would lead us to Dibi. It was a burning hot day, For the past 10 days, clouds had banked up each evening, and there had been distant thunder and lightning. Now it rained almost continuously for 3 days, and intermittently for the next 4, often with thunderstorms, especially at night. They were miserable days. It was maddening to ride along drenched to the skin and watch the driving rain soak into the sand. For although I was bitterly cold, I was also thirsty. We had no idea where we should find more water, and were again rationing ourselves to a pint a day. We had nothing with us except a few small pots in which to catch the rain, not that we could afford the time to stop. My companions were worried about the camels, and warned me that we might wake up any morning and find some of them dead, killed in their weakened state by the ulcers which were eating into them. Each morning I looked anxiously to see if they were still alive. One night there was a terrific storm, which started soon after dark and revolved around us until dawn. On that bare plain there was no sort of shelter. We could only lie cowering on the ground while the lightning slashed through the darkness of driven clouds and the thunder crashed about our ears. I had placed my rug and sheepskin over my sleeping bag. On other nights these had kept me fairly dry, but tonight the weight of water was too great to be turned aside. It flowed over me like an icy torrent. Sometimes the rain stopped, and I peered out to see, silhouetted against the night by the almost continuous flashes of lightning, the dark shapes where the others lay beneath their coverings, like grave mounds on a wet seashore, and the group of sodden animals squatting tail to storm. Then I would hear the muffled drumming of the rain as it came down once more. I was certain that some of our camels would die that night, but in the morning they were still alive. At dawn, there was no wood dry enough to light a fire. We exchanged once more the sodden misery of the night for the cold, dripping discomfort of the day, as we forced the unwilling camels forward into the wind and stinging rain. Nothing grew here but occasional matted growths of saltbush, whose juicy green foliage gave an irritating illusion of fertility to depressions which were really more sterile than the surrounding sands. That evening the starving camels, finding nothing else, ate these bushes, and suffered next day from the inevitable diarrhea. We tied their tails sideways to our saddlery to prevent them from flicking messily over our clothes. There was no food in their stomachs, but this loss of liquid would entail immediate thirst. Luckily, we came on a well, a shallow hole in hard sand, discernible from a distance only by the carpet of camel droppings that surrounded it. We tasted the water, but it was too brackish to drink. The thirsty camels, however, drank as if they could never have enough. While we watered them, a gleam of pale sunlight flooded across the wet plain like slow, sad music. Then it started to rain again. Binkabina coaxed a fire to burn and cooked a large meal of rice in water from the well, but it tasted horrible, and most of it remained uneaten. Next day was fine and sunny, and our spirit rose as the sun dried our clothes and warmed our bodies. My companion sang as we rowed across sands which looked as if they had been uncovered by an outgoing tide. They were Bedu, and it had rained, not scattered showers, but downpours which might well have covered all the desert. God's bounty, they called it, and rejoiced at the prospect of rich grazing that would last for years. As I rowed across these interminable naked sands, it seemed incredible that in 3 months' time they would be covered with flowering shrubs. Eskimos, enduring the cold and the darkness of the Arctic winter, can count the days till the sun appears. But here in southern Arabia the Bedou have no certainty of spring. Often there is no rain, and even if there is, it may fall at any time of the year. Generally the bitter winters turn to blazing summers over a parched and lifeless land. Binkabina told me now that he only remembered 3 springs in his life. Occasional springtimes such as these were all the Bedou ever knew of the gentleness of life. A few years' relief from the anxiety of want was the most they ever hoped for. It seemed to me pathetically little, and yet I knew that magnificently it was enough. As we rode along, The others spoke of years when it had rained, and Bin Kabina told me that never in his life had he known such rain as this. Then inevitably they spoke of the great flood in Darfur of 60 years ago. I had myself seen palm trunks which had been jammed by this flood 18 feet up among the rocks in the cliffs of the Wadi Adam, where the valley was more than 1,000 yards wide. We speculated as to how many days it must have rained to produce this flood, which had occurred in summer when it was warm. I wondered how long a man could survive such rain in winter before he died of exposure. It rained again in the evening, and continued to do so intermittently for the next 3 days. On the afternoon of the 8th day since we had left Jabrin, I reckoned that we must be near Debi Well, and my calculation was confirmed by the bearings which I took on 2 rocky peaks in a low escarpment to the north of us. An hour later, after again checking our position, I said that we were near the well. Bin Gabesha went on to look for it, and found it 1/4 mile away in a hollow in the sands. He came back and said, "By God, Mbarak, you are a guide!" But my justifiable satisfaction was spoilt when the water proved too brackish to drink. The camels, however, were thirsty and drank it greedily. Near the well there was a little fresh kasis, which I hoped foretold that we were on the edge of grazing, but the next day we marched 28 miles and found nothing all day. It rained again throughout the night. I was too cold and wet to sleep, too worried about what we should do. We had decided to go on to the Sapat Muti, still hoping to find Arabs. But as we had found no trace of any so far, I saw no reason why we should. My map marked only Abu Dhabi, about 250 miles farther on, and our water was nearly finished. We woke to a grey, lowering day, heavy with massed clouds threatening rain. With cold, numbed fingers, we loaded our camels, and then walked dispiritedly beside them, trying to bring some warmth into our bodies, while our long shirts flapped damply round our legs. I felt sure that the camels could not survive another day. Then, unbelievably, we came on grazing. It covered only a few square miles, and we walked straight into it. The camels hardly moved. They just ate and ate. We stood and watched them, and Bin Gabesha said to me, "This grazing has saved our lives." Next day we crossed the Sabhat Muti. We decided we must make a detour and cross these salt flats near their head, otherwise the camels might become inextricably bogged, especially after the recent heavy rain. They would only have to sink in as far as their knees to be lost. Camels are always bad on greasy surfaces, so we fastened knotted cords under their feet to stop them from slipping. Here the salt flats were divided into 3 arms by crescent-patterned drifts of sterile white sand. The flats themselves were covered with a crust of dirty salt, which threw up a glare into our faces, and even through half-closed eyes stabbed deep into my skull. The camels broke through this crust and floundered forward through liquid black mud. It took us 5 unpleasant, anxious hours to get across. On the far side we camped among undulating, utterly lifeless white sands, where even the salt bushes were dead, and their stumps punctured our naked feet like needles. It was 11 days since we had left Jabrin. In the evening we had a long and anxious discussion. Muhammad had at last to admit that he knew nothing about this country, and my map was a blank as far as Abu Dhabi, which was still 200 miles away. We had only a few gallons of water left. We should never get there unless we found water, and none of us had any idea if there were any wells along the coast. Muhammad said that we should probably find Bedu. He had been saying this since we left Layla, and we had come 350 miles without meeting any. Finally, in desperation, I suggested that we should try to find the Liwa Oasis, which I reckoned was only about 100 miles away. I had not yet been there, but Bin Kabina had visited 3 of the settlements from Balak Well when he fetched food for us the year before. He agreed that he would recognize the shape of the dunes at Liwa if I could guide us there. Unfortunately, I did not have with me the compass traverse which I had then made. Liwa was written in large letters across the map, but it was marked from hearsay, for no European other than myself had been near there. I puzzled over this map. Each time I fixed a bearing, some reason or other made me think I was wrong. The others sat round and watched me as I worked in the failing light. We all knew that if I went wrong and we missed Liwa, we should be heading back into the empty quarter. It was a frightening thought. But to look for Liwa seemed to be our only chance. Next morning, after travelling for 12 miles across flat white sands, we came to a succession of dune chains, each of which, when approached from the west, showed up in turn as a wavy silver-blue wall, 3 to 4 feet high, running out of sight to north and south along the top of an orange-red slope 1 mile wide. Their farther sides fell away into a jumble of hollows. They gradually became larger and more complicated and developed into high but uniform dune ranges and swelling downs, full of crescent-shaped hollows and deep potholes. The steeper sides of many of these hollows showed marks where water from the recent heavy rain had flowed down, and in some places the crust formed by the rain had been pitted by hailstones. Here we found grazing, and noticed the tracks of hares, fennec foxes, honey badgers and monitor lizards. On the 28th of February, we found a filled-in well at the bottom of a deep hollow. Binkabina climbed to a summit and shouted down to us, "I can see the sands of Liwa!" We climbed up to join him, and I saw the great mountains of golden sand where we had been the year before. We were safe now, but no one commented on the fact. Mohammed merely said, "Those dunes are rather like those in Ghanim." Next day we found a shallow well where the water was drinkable, though brackish. It was 15 days since we had left Jabrin, and we had perhaps 2 gallons of water left in the skins. We arrived at Balakh on the 4th of March, passing the hollow where Binkabina and I had camped and starved for 3 days on our last journey. It was a still hot afternoon. Next morning we found a small Manasir encampment on the edge of Liwa, and persuaded a man to guide us to Abu Dhabi. He told us that 2 months earlier a raiding party from Dubai, 300 strong, had surprised an encampment not far away, and killed 52 Manasir, losing 5 themselves, but that since then peace had been made between the sheikhs of Abu Dhabi and Dubai. We had heard about this raid when we were in Layla. We were now on the western edge of Liwa, which our guide said extended eastward for 3 days' journey. I should have liked to explore this famous oasis, but our camels were exhausted, and we ourselves were worn out. Our food was nearly finished, and it was difficult to buy anything here but dates. I knew that we must go direct to Abu Dhabi, and could only hope that perhaps I should be able to come back later. We passed through the settlements of Kutuf and Daufir. Palms were planted along the salt flats, close under high, steep-sided dunes, and in hollows in the sands. The groves were fenced in, and other fences were built along the dune tops, to try to control the movement of the sands, which in a few places had partly buried the trees. They were carefully spaced, and evidently well tended. There was no other cultivation, probably because of the salt on the surface of the ground. Water was abundant at a depth of between 7 and 20 feet. It was scarcely brackish, tasting only a little flat. The Arabs here were Bani Yas. They lived in rectangular cabins made from palm fronds, built for the sake of coolness on the downs above the palm groves, 2 or 3 cabins being enclosed by a high fence and inhabited by 1 family. They owned some camels and a few donkeys and goats, and in the summer many of them went to Abu Dhabi to join the pearling fleet as divers. We left Liwa on the 7th of March. Abu Dhabi was still 150 miles away, but now we had a guide. We were very tired and were no longer sustained by the struggle to survive, so each day's march became a plodding weariness, during which we were inclined to quarrel over trifles. It rained at intervals during these days, sometimes heavily. We reached the coast and followed it eastward, through desolate country. There were limestone ridges, drifts of white sand, and stretches of gravel dotted with tussocks of woody grass and shriveled plants. Salt flats ran far out to sea, but yellow haze made it impossible to distinguish where the salt flats ended and the sea began. The scene was colourless, without tones or contrast. We descended to the salt flats, and led our slithering camels across this greasy surface to the creek which separates Abu Dhabi from the mainland. We waded through the sea, rested for a while outside the stone fort which guards the ford, and then went on to the town, arriving there early in the afternoon. It was the 14th of March. We had left Manwak on the 6th of January. A large castle dominated the small, dilapidated town which stretched along the shore. There were a few palms, and near them was a well where we watered our camels, while some Arabs eyed us curiously, wondering who we were. Then we went over to the castle and sat outside the walls, waiting for the sheikhs to wake from their afternoon slumbers. 13. The Trucial Coast. From Abu Dhabi we go to Buraimi, where we stay for a month with Zayed bin Sultan, and then travel to Sharjah. From Dubai I sail by dhow to Bahrain. The castle gates were shut and barred, and no one was about. We unloaded our camels and lay down to sleep in the shadow of the wall. Near us, some small cannon were half buried in the sand. The ground around was dirty, covered with the refuse of sedentary humanity. The Arabs who had watched us watering had disappeared. Kites wheeled against a yellow sky above a clump of tattered palms, and two dogs copulated near the wall. In the evening, a young Arab came out from a postern gate, walked a little way across the sand, squatted down and urinated. When he had finished, Muhammad called to him and asked if the sheikhs were sitting, an Arab expression for giving audience. The boy answered no, not yet, and Muhammad told him to tell them that an Englishman had arrived from the Hadramaut and was waiting to see them. The boy asked, "Where is the Englishman?" And Muhammad pointed to me and said, "That's him." Half an hour later, a grey-bearded Arab came out, asked us a few questions, and went back into the castle. He came out again a little later and invited us in. He led us up some stairs to a small carpeted room, where Shakbut, the ruler of Abu Dhabi, and his brothers, Hiza and Khalid, were sitting. They were dressed in Saudi fashion, in long white shirts, gold-embroidered cloaks, and white headcloths, which fell round their faces and were held in place with black woolen head-ropes. Shakbut's dagger was ornamented with gold. They rose as we came in, and after we had greeted them and shaken hands, Shakbut invited us to be seated. He was a pale, slightly built man, with small, regular features, a carefully trimmed black beard and large, dark eyes. He was courteous, even friendly, but aloof. He spoke softly, moved slowly and deliberately, and seemed to impose a rigid restraint on a naturally excitable temper. I suspected that he mistrusted all men, and for this he had reason, since of the 14 previous rulers of Abu Dhabi, only 2 had died peacefully in power. 8 of them had been murdered, and 4 had been driven out by rebellion instigated by their families. Hiza was very different from Shakbut. He was large and jovial, with a thick black beard covering half his chest, whereas Khalid was chiefly remarkable for a loose front tooth, which he poked at with his tongue. Shakbut called for coffee, and it was produced by an attendant in a saffron-coloured shirt. After we had drunk it, and eaten a few dates, Shakbut asked about our journey. Later I mentioned that I visited the outskirts of Liwa the year before. Hiza said, "We heard rumours from some Awamir that a Christian had been there, but we disbelieved them. We could not believe that a European could have come and gone without being seen. Bedou news, as you know, is often unreliable. We thought they must have been talking of Thomas, who crossed the sands 16 years ago." Shakbut then discussed the war in Palestine, and ended with a diatribe against the Jews. Bin Kabina was obviously puzzled and whispered to me, "Who are the Jews? Are they Arabs? Later, the sheikhs escorted us to a large, dilapidated house near the market. We climbed up a rickety staircase to a bare room, carpeted ready for our arrival. Shahbout ordered two of his attendants to look after us, and then said that he would leave us now as we must be tired, but would come and see us in the morning. When I asked him about our camels, he said they would be taken into the desert where there was grazing, and brought back when we required them. But he added that would not be for many days, for we had come a long way, and now we must rest here in comfort. He smiled at me and said, "This is your home, for as long as you will stay with us." When it was dark, servants arrived carrying a large tray, heaped with rice and mutton, and many small dishes filled with dates and various kinds of sweetmeats. After we had fed, they sat among us with easy informality and talked. In Arab households, servants count as part of the family. There is no social distinction between them and their masters. Merchants from the marketplace and Bedou who were visiting the town came in to hear our news. A hurricane lamp smoked through a broken glass but gave some light. It was cosy and very friendly, and pleasing to feel that for a while we had no further need of travelling, that we could eat and sleep at will. I wondered why people ever cluttered up their rooms with furniture. For this bare simplicity seemed to me infinitely preferable. I remembered how, 2 years before, I had ridden in to Taif at sunset on a donkey, with two Arab companions and three half-naked Yemeni pilgrims, who had joined company with us. We had come a long way across the mountains from the borders of the Yemen. We found a room and a lodging for pilgrims, an empty cubicle, one of several opening onto a courtyard. The others were all occupied. We swept it out, furnished it with our rugs, and borrowed a lamp. One of the Yemenis fetched us food from the market, grilled meat, rice and flaps of bread, sour milk, watermelons and sweet black grapes. When we had fed, our neighbours came in and entertained us with their talk. I had everything that I could want, food, shelter and good company, after long days upon the road. In the morning, I called upon the king's grandson, who was acting as governor of Taif. I looked forward to the civilized comfort of Arab hospitality, but, thinking to please, he arranged for me to stay in the new hotel, where the rooms were filled with furniture in the Victorian style. On the walls were framed prints of Scottish lochs and Swiss chalets. There was electric light, fans and tinned food served by a Sudanese soufregi. My two companions were housed elsewhere. Some Egyptians were staying in the hotel, townsmen from Cairo, with whom I had nothing in common. I could not even understand their speech. I was lonely, bored, and uncomfortable, and I marvelled that Arabs should wish to ape our ways. We stayed for 20 days at Abu Dhabi, a small town of about 2,000 inhabitants. Each morning the sheikhs visited us, walking slowly across from the castle. Shahbout, a stately figure in a black cloak, a little ahead of his brothers, followed by a throng of armed retainers. We talked for an hour or more, drinking coffee and eating sweets, and after they had left us, we visited the market where we sat cross-legged in the small shops, gossiping and drinking more coffee. Or we wandered along the beach and watched the dhows being corked and treated with shark oil to prepare them for the pearling season, the children bathing in the surf, and the fishermen landing their catch. Once they brought in a young dugong, or sea cow, which they had caught in their nets. It was about 4 feet long, a pathetically helpless-looking creature, hideously ugly. They said its meat was good eating, and that its skin made sandals. We had many visitors who made themselves at home in our room, often remaining overnight. They just rolled up in their cloaks and went to sleep among us on the floor. One of them was a Rashid called Bakit al-Dahaimi. He had enlisted 2 years before among the sheikh's retainers, and won a reputation as a fighter during the war with Dubai. I had already heard of his doings when I was on the southern coast. He was a likely-built man of about 30, of average height, with a sallow face and close-set eyes. He wore a yellow shirt and a brown headcloth. He stayed with us for 3 days. My Rashid were very impressed by him, and frequently quoted what he had said, but I disliked him on sight. Hearing that I was going to Bahraini, he announced that he would travel with us. But I arranged with Shakhbut that he should be sent on ahead to give Zaid bin Sultan, Shakhbut's brother at Bahraini, word of our coming. Al-Dahemi was to make trouble for me in the future. I was anxious to penetrate into Oman and to visit the places which Stayun had described to me the year before while we waited in the Wadi Al-Ain for the others to come back from Ibri. I believed that my best chance of getting there would be from Bahraini, and I hoped that Zaid would be able to help me. It was too late in the season to attempt a journey into Oman that year, and anyway I needed a rest. My mind was taut with the strain of living too long among Arabs. But I could at least go up to Bahraini and make some discreet inquiries about Oman. I left Abu Dhabi with my four Rashid and a guide provided by Shakhbut on the 2nd of April. Bahraini was about 100 miles away, and it took us 4 days to get there. We had plenty of food and were no longer tired, and there was good grazing. Hiza had lent me a splendid camel to ride. These Albul Falah sheikhs owned many thoroughbreds from Oman. The Arabs in Abu Dhabi had been inclined to disparage our animals, contrasting them with those owned by their sheikhs, until Bin Gabesha was provoked to say, "Your sheikh's camels are admittedly wonderful animals, pictures of beauty. I am a Bedou, I can appreciate them. But there is not one of them that would do the journey ours have just done." And his listeners were silent, for there was truth in what the indignant boy said. The Batina camels from the Oman coast are famed throughout Arabia for their speed and comfort, but they are accustomed to being hand-fed on dates and are useless when food and water are short. The Wahiba, in the interior of Oman, own a famous breed, the Banat Farah, or the Daughters of Joy, and the Duru own the equally famous Banat Al-Hamra, or the Daughters of the Red One. These are hardier than the Batina camels, but the Rashid said that none of them would survive for long in the empty quarter. The evening before we reached Bahraini, I was lying contentedly on the ground watching Bin Kabina roasting some toadstools that he had found while herding the camels. They were creamy-tasting and delicious. There were also truffles here, which were even better. Bin Gabesha tickled my foot, and instinctively kicking out and catching him in the solar plexus, I knocked him out. Anxiously I bent over him, but Bin Kabina said, "He is all right, he is only knocked out." And a few seconds later, Bin Gabesha sat up. He said reproachfully, "Why do you try to kill your brother?" And when I protested, he laughed and said, "Don't be silly. Of course I realize it was an accident." I asked Bin Kabina, "What would you have done if I really had killed Bin Gabesha?" And he answered at once, "I should have killed you." When I protested that it would have been an accident, he said grimly, "That would have made no difference." He was joking, and yet I knew that Bedou demand a life for a life, whether the killing was intentional or accidental. Sometimes, when their temper has cooled, they may agree to accept blood money, especially if the killing was accidental. But their immediate reaction is to exact vengeance. In Abu Dhabi, we had met a Rashid lad who had been shot through the hand while raiding the Bani Kitab. Muhammad told him, "As soon as Mubarak has gone off to his country, we will avenge you. We will catch a boy of your own age from the Bani Kitab, hold his hand over a rifle and blow it off." Next morning, we approached Mawaik, one of the 8 small villages in the Bahraini oasis. It was here that Zaid lived. As we came out of the red dunes onto a gravel plain, I could see his fort, a large square enclosure, of which the mud walls were 10 feet high. To the right of the fort, behind a crumbling wall half buried in drifts of sand, was a garden of dusty, ragged palm trees, and beyond the palms, the isolated hog's back of Jabal Hafit, about 10 miles away, and 5,000 feet high. Faintly in the distance, over the fort, I could see the pale blue outlines of the Oman mountains. Some 30 Arabs were sitting under a thorn tree in front of the fort. Our guide pointed and said to me, "The sheikh is sitting." We couched our camels about 30 yards away and walked over, carrying our rifles and camel sticks. I greeted them and exchanged the news with Zaid. He was a powerfully built man of about 30 with a brown beard. He had a strong, intelligent face, with steady, observant eyes, and his manner was quiet but masterful. He was dressed very simply in a beige-coloured shirt of Armani cloth, and a waistcoat which he wore unbuttoned. He was distinguished from his companions by his black head-rope, and the way in which he wore his headcloth, falling about his shoulders, instead of twisted round his head in the local manner. He wore a dagger and cartridge belt. His rifle lay on the sand beside him. I had been looking forward to meeting him, for he had a great reputation among the Bedou. They liked him for his easy and formal ways, and his friendliness, and they respected his force of character, his shrewdness, and his physical strength. They said admiringly, "Zaid is a Bedou. He knows about camels, can ride like one of us, can shoot, and knows how to fight." A servant brought rugs for us to sit on. Zaid had been sitting on the bare sand. The servant then produced the inevitable coffee and dates. Zaid asked me questions about my journey, about the distances and the wells we had used, about Jabrin and the Saudis we had met in Layla and Sulayr. He was well informed about the desert, and especially interested when I told him that I had been through the Duru country the year before, and expressed his surprise that the Duru had allowed me to pass. I told him that I had pretended to be a Syrian merchant, and he said laughingly, "I should have known at once that you weren't." He mentioned that an Englishman called Bird was staying in Baremi, in another of the villages, trying to persuade the tribes to let a company look for oil. I gathered that he was having little success. I had met Dick Bird 3 years before, when he was a political officer in Bahrain. He was interested in and sympathetically disposed towards the Arabs, and we later became friends. But I realized that if, in the eyes of the local tribesmen, I became identified with an oil company, it would greatly lessen my chances of getting into Oman, and I therefore decided to stay with Zaid and not with Bird, while I was in Baremi. Late in the afternoon, a servant announced that lunch was ready, and we went into the fort. We passed through a wicket into a porch where armed men were sitting on a low earthen bench. A few months earlier, they had been at war. They stood up as we came in. Beyond the porch was a sandy courtyard, in which there was a tame gazelle and a bull camel that was rutting and dangerous. Zaid showed us into a large bare room on the left of the porch, lit by two small windows at ground level, opening on the yard. Our saddlebags had been brought in, and carpets laid on the earthen floor. Zaid fed with us, a large meal of meat and rice, with side dishes of dates and curds and bowls of sour milk. I stayed with Zaid for nearly a month. In the mornings, after we had breakfasted on tea and bread, a servant would come in and tell us that the sheikh was sitting. We would go out and join him. Sometimes Zaid would be on the bench in the porch, but more often under a tree outside the fort. He would call for coffee, and we would sit there chatting till lunchtime, though we were frequently interrupted. Visitors would arrive, Bedou from the sands, or from Saudi Arabia, tribesmen from Oman, or perhaps a messenger from Shakhbut in Abu Dhabi. Everyone rose as they approached, and then Zaid would invite them to be seated and listen to their news. As they approached, I tried to guess where they came from, noting the way they wore their clothes and saddled their camels. Sometimes they were Rashid or Awamir, and then, sitting beside my companions, they asked news of their kinsmen in the south. They were different from the Bani Yas and Manasseh, who comprised most of Zaid's retainers, hardier and more refined. Perhaps an Arab would get up from the circle, sit down immediately in front of Zaid, hit the ground a wallop with his stick to attract attention, and, interrupting us as we spoke together, would say, "Now, Zaid, what about those camels which were taken from me?" Zaid, who might be in the middle of a sentence, would stop and listen to the man's complaint. Most of the complaints were about camels. Frequently the complainant averred that some notorious outlaw, who might well be sitting with us, had taken his animals. Zaid had many of these outlaws in his entourage, since it suited him better to have them with him than in some rival sheikh's fort. Bin Gabesha, who sat beside me with his rifle between his knees — he was never parted from it — was soon to be numbered among them. I watched him listening with interest as each case was heard. Both sides argued noisily and with frequent interruptions, as was their wont. Zaid had no desire to offend the outlaw, nor to lose his reputation for justice. It was a proof of his skill that he usually satisfied both sides by his judgment. I remember on one occasion a woman had run away from her husband, and her brothers were anxious that he should divorce her. The husband said that he would only do so if her family returned the full bride price. This, they argued, was unfair, as she had lived with him for years. Zaid consulted some of the greybeards who sat with us, and declared that the family should return half the bride price. On another occasion, a manasseh had shot his sister. We had heard the shot while we were sitting in our room. We soon learnt that she had been seduced by one of Zaid's Bani Yas retainers. Everyone, except my Rashid, thought that her brother had done right. Bin Kabina said to me, "Poor little girl. It was a brutal thing to kill her." Next day Zaid sentenced the man who had seduced her to be flogged. Visiting Bedu would come up and ask for a present before they left, many of them having apparently come for no other purpose. I was interested to see that they were as importunate to Zaid as they were to me. I recalled that some of the Rashid on the southern coast thought it worthwhile to ride 1,400 miles to Riyadh and back in the expectation of getting something from Ibn Saud. A year later, Bin Kabina and Bin Gabesha went to Muscat from Bahraimi in the middle of the summer. Their camels were already worn out, and I had hoped that they would rest them against my return. In Muscat, they each collected 10 shillings from the Sultan. It is true that they had hoped to lift some camels on the way back to Bahraimi, but by then they were too well known, and the alarm was out. Even so, they did not seem to think that their 500-mile journey had been in vain. Zaid, as Shakput's representative, controlled 6 of the villages in Bahraimi. The other 2 acknowledged the Sultan of Muscat as their nominal overlord, as did the tribes who lived in and around the mountains, northwards from Ibri to the Musandam Peninsula, although in fact this area was independent tribal territory. Ibri itself, and the interior of Oman to the south of this town, was ruled by the Imam. His authority was strong in the mountains and in all the towns, but was weak among the large and powerful Bedu tribes of the Duru and Wahiba, who live on the steppes bordering on the sands. Ibn Saud had undisputed control over the Murrah beyond the Sabbat Muti, and his officials sometimes collected taxes from the Bedu who lived in Dafara. But recently they had been driven out of Liwa by the Bani Yas, who acknowledged Shakput as their overlord. It was 80 years since Saudi forces, known in those days as Wahhabis, had occupied the Bahraimi. Now the only Saudis here were a few merchants engaged chiefly in the slave trade, which still flourished in the 2 villages not controlled by Zaid. Each of the Trucial sheikhs had a band of armed retainers, recruited from the tribes, but only Shakput had any authority among the tribes themselves, and he maintained this authority by diplomacy, not by force. There was no regular force anywhere on the Trucial coast, nor in Bahraimi, which could be used to support the authority of the sheikhs. The Trucial Oman scouts had not yet been raised, and although the RAF had an aerodrome at Sharjah, it was only a staging post on the route to India. Zaid was often busy during these days, helping Bird with his interminable discussions with tribal sheikhs from the surrounding country. Bird used to come over to Maweki in his car. Zaid also had a car, and these were the only 2 nearer than Dubai on the coast. Bird was friendly but suspicious, wondering if I was working for some rival company. I kept away from him when visiting tribesmen were about. Anyway, I was averse to all oil companies, dreading the changes and disintegration of society which they inevitably caused. The Iraq Petroleum Company had signed agreements with the Sultan of Muscat and with the Trucial sheikhs, covering the area around Bahraimi, and Bird was now trying to persuade the tribes to accept these agreements. It was not easy, since Zaid had not authority south of Bahraimi, and the Sultan, whose authority was at this time purely nominal, had no effective representative in the area. Each sheikh, excited by avarice, was noisily asserting his independence, while each of his tribesmen fancied that he could get special terms for himself by refusing to acknowledge any authority other than his own. None of this helped my chances of getting into Oman, which seemed slight enough at the best of times. The interior of Oman had remained one of the least known of the inhabited places of the East, even less well known than Tibet. It was first visited by Wellsted in 1835, and he was followed 2 years later by the French botanist Alker Eloy. Colonel Miles made two long journeys through the country in 1876 and 1885, while he was British consul in Muscat. And in 1901, Sir Percy Cox travelled southward from Bahrami to Nazwa and then on to Muscat. Oman is largely inhabited by the Abadis, a sect of the Kharijites, who separated themselves from the rest of Islam at the time of Ali, the fourth caliph, and have been noted ever since for their condemnation of others. The Abadis have always maintained that their imam or religious leader should be elected. The Abu Sa'id dynasty, which ruled Oman from 1744, and to which the present Sultan of Muscat belongs, succeeded, however, in establishing an hereditary succession. But its neglect of the elective principle had always been resented by its subjects. The growth of Omani sea power between 1784 and 1856, overseas conquest, of which Zanzibar was the most important, and especially the removal of the capital from Rustaq to Muscat on the coast, weakened the hold of the al-Busaid rulers over the interior of the country, while foreign treaties and outside interference added to the fanatical resentment of the tribesmen. In 1913, the tribes, both Ghaffari and Hanawi, rebelled and elected Salim bin Rashid al-Karusi as their imam. The Sultan of Muscat rapidly lost all control over the interior, and by 1915 the imam was threatening Muscat. His forces, however, suffered a serious defeat when they attacked a British force outside Mathra. The imam was murdered in 1920, and Muhammad bin Abdullah al-Khalili was then elected. In the same year, the Treaty of Sib was signed between the Sultan and the Omani sheikhs, not between the Sultan and the imam. By this treaty, the Sultan agreed not to interfere in the internal affairs of Oman. The present imam, Muhammad bin Abdullah, was now an old man, a fanatical reactionary and bitterly hostile to the Sultan and to all Europeans. The interior of Oman was consequently more difficult for a European to penetrate in 1948 than it had been when Wellsted went there more than 100 years before. For both Wellsted and his three successors had travelled under the protection of sultans of Muscat, who were recognised by the tribes in the interior. I told Zaid of my plans, and he promised to help me when I came back in the autumn. He warned me, however, to speak of them to no one else. I did not even tell my Rashid, for I had learnt that the most effective way to spread a story was to tell it to one or two Arabs under a pledge of secrecy. Zaid offered to send me down to the coast in his car, but I said I would go by camel. This would postpone a little longer my parting with my companions. He then said that he would lend me Ghazala, the gazelle, and this delighted me, for she was the most renowned camel in Oman, and may well have been the finest in all Arabia. Muhammad said to me, "Any Bedou would give much to say that he had ridden Ghazala." We left Mweki on the 1st of May, accompanied by 4 of Zaid's retainers, before we should pass through Bani Kitab territory, and this tribe was at war with Rashid. We rode northwards along the edge of the sands, parallel with the mountains. It was attractive country. Many watercourses ran down from the foothills and ended in the sands. They were filled with gaff and acacias, which gave food to our camels, and to us shelter from the sun. Already the weather was hot. We dawdled along, for I was reluctant to arrive at Sharjah. Bin Gabesha and I hunted wild ass, and shot 2 of them. They looked very different from the graceful, spirited animals I had seen in the Danakil country, and they were later identified as feral donkeys by the British Museum. They were difficult to skin, for our daggers were blunt. It was midday and the sun was very hot. There was no shade on the stony plain where we had found these donkeys, and we had no water with us. While I had been at Mwaki, I had hunted tar on Jabal Hafit, camping for a week under the mountain with Bin Kabina and Bin Gabesha and two of Zaid's Arabs. The Arabian tar had never previously been seen by a European, although they had been named from two skins bought in Muscat by Dr. Jaya Carr in 1892. They resembled goats and had very thick, short horns. It was exhausting work hunting them, for the mountains rose 4,000 feet above our camp, and the slopes were everywhere steep and usually sheer, without water or vegetation. The tar fed at night, round the foot of the mountain, but the only ones we saw were near the top. The Arabs shot two females, and we picked up the skull of a male. We had made ourselves sandals from green hide, without which we could never have climbed these cruel limestone rocks. We arrived at Sharjah on the 10th of May. We skirted the aerodrome, passing piles of empty tins, broken bottles, coils of rusting wire and fluttering bits of paper. A generator thumped in the distance, and a jeep roared down a track, leaving a stink of petrol fumes behind it. We approached a small Arab town on an open beach. It was as drab and tumble-down as Abu Dhabi, but infinitely more squalid, for it was littered with discarded rubbish which had been mass-produced elsewhere. To me, the sun-blistered skeleton of a car seemed infinitely more horrible than the carcass of a camel which we passed a little further on. I stayed with Noel Jackson, the political officer on the Trucial Coast, and in the peaceful comfort of his rooms forgot for a while the resentment which I had felt that morning. Later he took me round to the RAF mess, listening to their talk while a wireless blared in a corner and the barman served drinks. I realized that these officers could have as little understanding of Bedou life as Bin Kabina or Bin Gabesha had of theirs. I could now move without effort from one world to the other as easily as I could change my clothes. But I appreciated that I was in danger of belonging to neither. When I was among my own people, a shadowy figure was always at my side, watching them with critical, intolerant eyes. I said goodbye to my companions at Sharjah, hoping to be with them again in 4 months' time. I then went to Dubai and stayed with Edward Henderson. We had been together in Syria during the war. He was now working for the Iraq Petroleum Company, making preparations for the development which was expected there, but of which there was mercifully, as yet, no sign. He lived in a large Arab house, overlooking the creek which divided the town, the largest on the Trucial Coast, with about 25,000 inhabitants. Many native craft were anchored in the creek, or were careened on the mud along the waterfront. There were booms from Kuwait, sambuks from Sur, jowl boats, and even a large stately bakhila, with a high carved stern, on which I could make out the Christian monogram IHS. On one of the embossed panels. This work must have been copied originally from some Portuguese galleon. I wondered how many times it had been copied since, exactly to the last scroll and flourish. Commander Alan Villiers, who had sailed in a boom from Zanzibar to Kuwait, believed that there were only two or three of these bakhilas still in existence. To the English, all these vessels were dhows, a name no longer remembered by the Arabs. Once, however, dhows were the warships of this coast, carrying as many as 400 men and 40 to 50 guns. Miles saw the last of them at Bahrain, painted with two tiers of ports. Naked children romped in the shallows, and rowing boats patrolled the creek to pick up passengers from the mouths of alleys between high coral houses, surmounted with square wind turrets, and pleasingly decorated with plaster moulding. Behind the diversity of houses which lined the waterfront were the souks, covered passageways, where merchants sat in the gloom, cross-legged in narrow alcoves among their piled merchandise. The souks were crowded with many races, pallid Arab townsmen, armed Bedou, quick-eyed and imperious, Negro slaves, Baluchis, Persians and Indians. Among them I noticed a group of Kashgai tribesmen in their distinctive felt caps, and some Somalis off a sambuk from Aden. Here life moved in time with the past. These people still valued leisure and courtesy and conversation. They did not live their lives at second hand, dependent on cinemas and wireless. I would willingly have consorted with them, but I now wore European clothes. As I wandered through the town, I knew that they regarded me as an intruder. I myself felt that I was little better than a tourist. I could have gone to Bahrain by aeroplane from Sharjah, but I preferred to go there by Dhow. The journey should have taken 4 days, but lasted 11. The Naukada, or skipper, was an old man, nearly blind, who spent most of his time asleep on the poop. The mate, an energetic negro, described what he saw, and the Naukada told him where to go. Once he woke the old man in the middle of the night to consult him. The Naukada gave his orders, but when the mate said, "Nonsense, uncle," he went grumbling back to sleep. The first night it blew a gale. The seas broke over the ship, and I was very sick. We had to shelter under the Persian coast, and there we remained for 3 days, since the wind, when it moderated, was against us. While waiting for the wind to shift, we were joined by 7 other dhows, great ocean-going booms, sailing back from Zanzibar to Kuwait. Their Naukadas rowed over to visit us, and we fed them on rice and dates and a large fish which we had just harpooned. They drank tea, smoked in turn from a hubble bubble, and described their voyage. But I found it difficult to follow their talk, for I did not know the terms they used. Then the wind changed, and we sailed for Bahrain. It was thrilling to watch these great dhows surging along beside us through the breaking seas. They were the last trading vessels in the world that made long voyages entirely by sail. Soon they too would disappear. When we were almost within sight of Bahrain, the wind dropped. For 4 days we lay, rolling slightly on an oily sea. The brief spring was past. The sky was without a cloud, and the damp heat wrapped itself round me like a wet towel. An occasional cat's paw of wind ruffled the surface of the sea, but died away as I watched. The brackish water in the rusty iron tank was warm as tepid tea. I was sick of rice and dates flavoured with rancid butter. The crew, who, like all Arabs, had an enviable capacity for sleeping when there was nothing else to do, rigged themselves an awning and slept interminably. And I reread H.A.L. Fisher's History of Europe, the only book I had with me. I was sailing on this dhow because I wanted to have some experience of the Arab as a sailor. Once there had been a great sea-going race, sailing their dhows round the coast of India to the East Indies and perhaps even farther. The Trucial coast, which we had just left, had been known and dreaded as the Pirate Coast. In the early 19th century, Juassimi pirates had fought our frigates on level terms on these very waters. But there was a deeper reason that had prompted me to make this journey. I had done it to escape a little longer from the machines which dominated our world. The experience would last longer than the few days I spent on the journey. All my life I had hated machines. I could remember how bitterly at school I had resented reading the news that someone had flown across the Atlantic or travelled through the Sahara in a car. I had realized even then that the speed and ease of mechanical transport must rob the world of all diversity. For me, exploration was a personal venture. I did not go to the Arabian Desert to collect plants, nor to make a map. Such things were incidental. At heart, I knew that to write, or even to talk of my travels, was to tarnish the achievement. I went there to find peace in the hardship of desert travel and the company of desert peoples. I set myself a goal on these journeys, and although the goal itself was unimportant, its attainment had to be worth every effort and sacrifice. Scott had gone to the South Pole in order to stand for a few minutes on one particular and almost inaccessible spot on the Earth's surface. He and his companions died on their way back, but, even as they were dying, he never doubted that the journey had been worthwhile. Everyone knew that there was nothing to be found on the top of Everest, but even in this materialistic age few people asked, "What point is there in climbing Everest? What good will it do anyone when they get there?" they recognize that even today there are experiences that do not need to be justified in terms of material profit. No, it is not the goal, but the way there that matters. And the harder the way, the more worthwhile the journey.